All right, we are going to start a series of looking at Jesus' parables. And what I'm hoping to do is give you some general information about parables, interspersed with looking at some specific examples of the parables. So I'm not going to give you, I'm not going to tell you every technical detail about parables right off and bore you to death and then start in, on another time on looking at the actual parables. So hopefully I have this set up so that you have just enough information to understand what I'm going to try to tell you from the parables that Jesus taught. So if you get too confused, talk to me later and let me know, and I'll see if I can reorganize what I'm doing, but hopefully this will work out good. So one of the ways that we look at Jesus' teaching is we look back and see him as a rustic traveling preacher who is trying to make his message as simple as possible for people who are uneducated and don't understand long words, right? Okay, so we kind of have the superior idea sometimes, we can grasp abstract concepts, but apparently Jesus' listeners could not, so they needed a bunch of illustrations to help them understand just basic general principles. So we take that idea, but we juxtapose it against another idea that has been put forward, in that Jesus' teaching was meant to confuse people. And only the unconfused were the ones who were really his followers and really understood what was going on. I don't know if you've ever heard that through your relationship in churches or whatever. We look at his teaching as if it's supposed to be really deep and really really hard to understand. And so then we try to dig out the meaning so that we can be sure that we're the ones who are in the in crowd. We're the ones that understand what's going on. So Jesus' teaching really is neither of these things. And across the board, we're going to look at Jesus' teaching as well as specifically his parables, with the idea that Jesus is trying to make things clear to people. These are stories that they understand. We look at them and sometimes we're confused because we don't have the cultural background. So we look at the parable of the 10 virgins waiting for the bridegroom, and we're like, we do not understand that at all. And so it must be something that's really hard to understand, so we're going to have to really dig deep to understand this parable. Well, that parable is straight from the life of the people, and they didn't have to dig all that deep to figure out what was going on. So we're going to do that with the parables, is try to look at Jesus' stories from the viewpoint and the culture of the people who are hearing them. So we're going to bring in history, and we're going to bring in culture, and we're going to bring in language and rhetoric. The way the parable is set up sometimes gives us clues as to what Jesus is talking about. So we're going to be doing all of that to show that these parables are not as confusing as we seem to think they are. Here it comes. I'm sorry. I'm really feeling much better. I just have the residual, congestion and stuff. Okay, so the first question that comes to mind is the same one that came to Jesus' disciples' mind when they heard him teaching in parables. Why is Jesus teaching in parables? Why isn't he doing the abstract theological concepts that we're used to hearing in church? He's telling stories. Okay, we've already kind of decided that these people are not the ignorant fishermen and farmers that we think they are. They're actually very intelligent people. So why is he using stories to teach them? His disciples actually asked him that in Matthew 13. So we're going to turn to Matthew 13, keeping a couple of things in mind. First of all, Jesus, in his teaching and in his parables, we're going to remember that Jesus did not come into the world to teach us how to be a better version of ourselves. His goal was not to make us into good people. The reason he came into the world, he said, and I quote, "I have come to show the world the Father." So let's look at Jesus' parables as if he is showing us the heart of the Father. So Matthew 13 is a series of seven parables. These are all what I call Kingdom of Heaven parables. Jesus is giving us a picture of the Kingdom of Heaven. They're set up in a specific order. There is a long parable, and then there's an explanation of that parable. And then there's another long parable and two short parables and an explanation of the long parable. And then there's two short parables and a long parable and an explanation of that long parable. We're not going to do all seven this morning. All right. So relax. But I do want to read the first one because it's a good way to start our understanding. I'm just going to read it. I'm not going to talk about it really all that much. So this is Matthew 13 and it starts in verse 3. "Then he told them many things in parables, saying, a farmer went out to sow his seed. As he was scattering the seed, some fell along the path, and the birds came and ate it up. Some fell on rocky places where it did not have much soil. It sprang up quickly because the soil was shallow. But when the sun came up, the plants were scorched, and they withered because they had no root. Other seed fell among thorns, which grew up and choked the plants. Still other seed fell on good soil, where it produced a crop, 160 or 30 times what was sown. He who has ears, let him hear." Okay, what I want to point out to you in that, and the reason I read it, is the ending of this parable where it says, where it produced a crop, 160 or 30 times what was sown. In our culture, we would not say it that way. If we were trying to impress somebody, we would say the crop produced 30, no, 60, no, 100 times what it was sowed. But this is a very specific Hebrew cultural idiom, the way it's laid out here, the way it starts with 100 and then 60 and then 30. When you read that and when you see that in that order like that, there's a couple of things you know. Number one, it's authentic to the Hebrew culture. The guy that wrote this down was a Jew. And number two, it is authentic to this time period. The guy that wrote this down was standing there listening to Jesus say it. So we can have confidence reading these seven parables that they are directly from the mouth of Jesus, directly recorded at the time, very close to the time when Jesus actually spoke them. And that's kind of important, especially in this day and age when we have so many Bible critics and so many, like, the authorities agree that Matthew wasn't written until AD 250, you know, or whatever. Well, no. The authorities, first of all, don't agree, because no authorities ever agree, right? But there are clues that we can dig out. If you know what you're looking for, you can see in the writing itself that shows when it was written, where it came from, and who actually wrote it down. And this is one of those clues. So moving forward into these next parables, we're going to remember that, yes, this indeed is authentic to words that Jesus spoke. So that's why I wanted to go over that first parable with you. And how many of you guys are familiar with that parable? How many of you have heard it before? It's a pretty common one. Okay, so then the disciples come to him after that parable and they say, "Why do you speak to the people in parables?" This is in your notes. Jesus answered them and he said to them, "Because it has been given to you to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been given. For whoever has, to him more will be given, and he will have abundance. But whoever does not have, even what he has will be taken away from him. Therefore, I speak to them in parables." That's a unit. Whenever you see a therefore, you look back to see what question it's answering. So this is the answer to the disciples' question, why do you speak to them in parables? Okay, well, that cleared it up nicely for you, right? So what Jesus is saying here, I'm speaking to them in parables, and he's contrasting it to speaking to the disciples. Because it has been given to you to know the mysteries. Basically, what Jesus is saying is, you have been hanging out with me. You have been listening to my words. I have been teaching you, and we've been able to go deeper than with this crowd of people. It has not been given to them. All these words that I have already given to you, they haven't heard. That's why I'm making it open and easy for them to understand at this point in their listening. Whoever has, to him will, more will be given. So if you already understand, you are able to take in more. If you don't have that understanding, it's not going to do you any good. Even the understanding you have will be taken away from you, which is probably a good thing, because that leaves the way open for a better understanding of what Jesus is trying to teach. So this is Jesus' answer to why he's teaching in parables, because I'm trying to make it easy for them to understand. Okay, and then he goes on to clarify by, Matthew tells us it's a prophet, if it is a prophecy from Isaiah. He goes on to clarify his answer by quoting that prophecy. So I'm going to read that, and then to the surprise of no one, we're going to actually go to that prophecy in Isaiah to look at it. As though seeing, they do not see, and hearing, they do not hear, nor do they understand. And in them the prophecy of Isaiah is fulfilled, which says, hearing you will hear, and shall not understand. Seeing you will see, and not perceive. For the hearts of this people have grown dull. Their ears are hard of hearing, and their eyes they have closed, lest they should see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, lest they should understand with their hearts, and turn, so that I should heal them. Okay, so this prophecy comes from Isaiah 6, verses 9 through 11. Take a look at the colors, because this again is, this is a classic example of a chiasm. So this is the inverted parallelism with a run-up. We've got a three-line warm-up, and then we have the inverted parallelism, or the chiastic structure of this prophecy. So take a look at the parallel lines. So go and say to this people, and then the people's hearts have become dull. So we have people leading into people's hearts. And then the last pink line, understand with their hearts. So we have three ideas of people's hearts. And then look at the yellow lines, ever hearing, but never understanding. They hardly hear with their ears, or hear with their ears. So, I mean, it's pretty obvious, right, how the parallel is like that. Okay, and then look at the green, ever seeing, but never perceiving. Close their eyes, or they might see with their eyes. So three lines about eyes. So you can see, I mean, I hope, can you see the inverted parallelism as a classic example? Okay, so we're going to take a look at this. Ever hearing, but never understanding. Ever seeing, but never perceiving. The people's hearts have become dull. Okay, and that word dull comes from, I've said before that the Hebrew language is a very picture-oriented language. This is the word for fat. The people's hearts have become fat. So think about that for a minute. A fat heart, meaning dull, or some versions will translate it as calloused. The heart has grown fat and lazy. The heart no longer responds. It's too sluggish to respond. That's what this is a picture of. The people's hearts have become fat. They don't hear with their ears, and they have closed their eyes. Okay, so I'm going to tell you a story to illustrate this idea of hearing and not understanding, seeing and not perceiving. This is a true story that happened, a long time ago now, up in Eagle River. This is back when cell phones were like a brand new thing, and Eagle River had just... There's a breeze up here. What? Slide back. Okay. Right. Eagle River had just implemented a new telephone system. And that's where they had everyone's telephone numbers tied to their address. So when someone called dispatch, 911, a light would light up showing the telephone number that it was called from and the address that telephone number was hooked to. So if they had to send out an ambulance or make a call, they would know right away. They wouldn't have to ask a person, where do you live? They would go, oh, you live right there. And they would be able to send the ambulance right there. Okay, well, an incident happened. There was a man and his wife at home, and a woman came, and shot the man and killed him, shot the wife, didn't kill her, but then she shot herself and killed herself. Okay, so the woman of the house now, who is wounded and dying, called 911. And the light lit up, and they said, yes, we will have an ambulance out there right away. Well, she waited, and she waited, and nobody came. And so, of course, she's on the phone with them, and she's explaining, nobody's here, nobody's here. She hears a siren coming, and then it disappears in the distance. And she's like, no, they've gone to the wrong place. And the dispatch person is telling her, no, we know right where you are. Someone will come, someone will be there. They're almost there. And nobody came, and nobody came. And finally, dispatch said, well, you live in a house with it's got a flag, an American flag in the front, right? And she's like, no, I don't. Well, how about, does it have an RV? No, I don't. No. So something was wrong with their system, but they wouldn't admit it. They just kept on going to the place where their system showed them they were supposed to go. Meanwhile, this woman is badly wounded and at home waiting for the ambulance to show up. Okay, so eventually they had to stop focusing on their map and listen to her words so that she could explain to them, go to this road, turn this direction, come to this house with this house number. And they did find her, and she did live. But this is a perfect example of hearing and seeing and not understanding or perceiving. So they were looking at their map, and they were saying, we know exactly where we're supposed to go. They were listening to her words and applying it to the map, but it didn't work out quite right. So they were turning. She would say, turn right, and they would turn right, but it was because of the wrong map, the wrong road. This is a picture of this prophecy in Isaiah. And Isaiah is talking to the people saying, you have the wrong basis for your understanding. And so the words that I'm saying and the things you're seeing are not going to mean anything. Okay, now Jesus takes this prophecy, which was made just before the Babylonians came in and destroyed the land and took them to captivity. Jesus applies this prophecy to the day and age that he is in, the people he's talking to. They are listening to the words, but they don't understand because their perceptions are wrong. They're looking at the wrong map. The people that Jesus is talking to, they had expectations. They expected the kingdom of heaven to look a certain way. And if it didn't look that way, they were confused. And rather than change their ideas, they tried to make the words fit into their ideas. So this is what Jesus is saying when he's bringing up this prophecy. But then we want to look at the center, which of course is the turning point of the prophecy. When we look at the chiasm, we always look at that center to find out, what is this about? And in many cases, it's about a turning point. And so we need to look at this word otherwise as the pivot point. Now, translations have been made, and the more contemporary with us the translations are, the odder they are, at least to my ears, the idea that they're trying to put across. So in some of the contemporary translations, we see, instead of otherwise or unless or perhaps, we see so that they won't, so that they can't, so that they don't understand, as if the person talking is actively trying to confuse them. It kind of culminates in the New Living Translation, where it says, I don't want them to understand. This is a wrong idea of what both Isaiah and Jesus are trying to say in this passage. And when you look at the chiastic structure, you can see and understand that it's a wrong idea, because it's a change point. Something has changed. Otherwise, unless perhaps, they do understand, and they might be able to see with their eyes, they might hear with their ears, they might understand with their hearts, and then they will turn, and I will heal them. I'm not trying to make it confusing for them. I want them to understand so that they turn and be healed. And those two are highlighted in blue because that turning point ties in with the end of this prophecy. Otherwise, they will turn, and I will heal them. So keep that in mind. as we go and take a look at these next parables that we're going to look at. So I said there were seven. We're going to look at the four short ones. The parable of the mustard seed. This is a short parable. Where is it? Another parable he put forth to them, saying, the kingdom of heaven is like. And here we have something that's going to be a little different than what you read. So if you're looking in your Bible, it's going to say, the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. So immediately we say, oh, mustard seed, kingdom of heaven, right? Okay. But the syntax of these, all these seven parables where it says, the kingdom of heaven is like. There's words for it, and there's like dative nouns and verbs that like hook together and stuff, and I'm not going to bore you with all that stuff. But what it means is that the kingdom of heaven is not being compared to an item. So how this should read and how we should translate this is, the kingdom of heaven is like this. And then the rest of the story is the whole picture of the kingdom of heaven. So what Jesus is saying is not the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, but the kingdom of heaven is like this. And then he tells a story that has a mustard seed in it. But we should understand the whole story as being a picture of the kingdom of heaven. Jesus is trying to teach us about what does the kingdom of heaven look like. The kingdom of heaven doesn't look like a mustard seed. The kingdom of heaven looks like what happens to the mustard seed. So let's take a look at that. The kingdom of heaven is like this. A mustard seed, which a man took and sowed in his field, which indeed is the least of all the seeds. But when it is grown, it is greater than the herbs and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and nest in its branches. Now, Western people have had a lot of trouble describing how a mustard seed can grow into a tree. And you will come up with a lot of ideas about this mustard seed and this tree. There is a tree that grows over in the Middle East that has flowers on it that looks like mustard seed flowers, but it's not a mustard tree. It's just a tree that's got yellow flowers that looks like mustard. And if you've been over there, you have seen the mustard plants that grow in the field, and they look like mustard plants. They don't look like trees. So how can Jesus say, oh, a mustard seed, tiny little seed, grows into a great big tree? Well, here's the point. If we try to explain how maybe these seeds grew into big trees in the Middle East and we just don't know about it, right? We're missing the point of the parable. The point of this parable, Jesus is using surprise. He expects his listeners to be surprised when a mustard seed grows into a tree. Mustard seeds don't grow into trees. But here's a mustard seed that does grow into a tree. Okay, so we should approach this with surprise. Okay, so the man plants a mustard seed and he expects it to grow into a mustard plant, but it does not. It grows into a tree. Jesus invites us to be surprised at the growth of the kingdom of heaven. The tree in the Old Testament has been a symbol of world power, especially trees that are big enough for birds to come and nest in the branches. So there's like four or five different places where a world power has been described as this tree, Egypt being one, Lebanon being one. Anyhow, so we need to look at this tree that surprisingly has grown from something that it shouldn't have grown from, and we need to see that Jesus is talking about this kingdom of heaven is going to be a world power, and the birds that are coming, birds are considered unclean. And so trees were not planted inside the city, because if they attracted birds, then you get bird droppings, and then you have this uncleanliness inside the city. So trees were kept outside of the city walls. They were kept out in fields. And so the birds coming to nest in the air, to us, that should symbolize that this kingdom of heaven, this tree, is going to attract not just the Jews, but the nations. So the first thing that we learn about the kingdom of heaven is it's going to be a surprise to the world. The nations are going to be attracted to the kingdom of heaven because of this surprising aspect of it. So that's what we should take from this idea of the mustard seed. Remember, Jesus is showing us the heart of the Father in these stories. Okay, let's read about the leaven. Another parable he spoke to them. The kingdom of heaven is like this. It's the whole story. It's not just the leaven. It's the whole story. Leaven, which a woman took and hid in 3 measures of meal. Okay. Then we have a pause. So leaven is not the dry yeast that we know from our bread making. But how many of you guys make sourdough bread? Okay. So leaven, to them, leaven across the board is sourdough. So you have a jar, you know, depending on how sloppy your sourdough is, you have a jar of liquid sourdough, or you have a chunk of sourdough dough that you add to the bread dough that you're making so that it leavens it. Okay, so Jesus is inviting his listeners to be amused. So this woman has this sourdough, this leaven, and she's like, I need to keep this safe. Where can I hide it? I know, I'll hide it here in my bread dough. Okay, all the listeners are laughing because they know that you can't hide leaven in bread dough. What's going to happen? Well, it's going to leaven the whole thing, and it's going to puff up and get all, if you make sourdough bread, you know, right? You can't hide leaven in bread dough. This is a picture of the kingdom of heaven. Okay, in their amusement, the people now understand you can't hide. You're not going to be able to hide this kingdom of heaven. It's going to make itself known. All right? So let's move on now to the treasure in the field. Now, up to now, these kingdom of heaven parables have had a major actor in them. We have the sower. We have a parable that I didn't read, a man who owns a field and he sows it and he has enemies. And then we have the man who plants the mustard seed. We have the woman who has the leaven. Okay, so there's a major player. And in each one of these, we understand that major player to be divine, a symbol of God himself or a symbol of the divine acting in the world. All right, so these next two parables, we're going to read them with that idea in mind. The major actor in these next two parables is a symbol of the divine action. This is going to be a little different than what you have understood this parable to mean in the past. But we're going to make it consistent with the parables which it's encased in. Okay, so let's read about the kingdom of heaven in the treasure. The kingdom of heaven is like this. It's not like a treasure. The kingdom of heaven is not the treasure hidden in the field. The kingdom of heaven is like this. It's the whole story. This is what the kingdom of heaven is like. Treasure hidden in a field, which a man found and hid. And for joy over it, he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. All right. How do we understand this very short parable? We need to have an idea of the cultural basis of what's going on here with this finding the treasure and buying this field. So we should have a couple of questions. Does it sound to us like the guy that found this treasure is cheating the owner of the field? So like if he knows that this field is worth way much more because it has this treasure in it, but he just buys the field and doesn't tell the owner about the treasure? I mean, that seems like, you know, should we emulate that? Is that what Jesus is saying? It's okay to cheat if you get what you want at the end. Should we copy that behavior? You know, I don't think that's what Jesus is saying here. So people who owned land did not sell their land unless there was a very pressing reason for them to sell it. They would sooner sell their children into slavery than sell their land, because their land was their livelihood. If you were a farmer and you had a piece of property and you were growing, you know, whatever you grew on it. You don't sell that. It's like selling your business. So we have to look at this as different than somebody just going, oh yeah, I'll give you $10,000 for that piece of land. Oh, well, yeah, that's probably more than it's worth, so yeah, I'll take it, right? This is not an open market transaction that we're talking about here. When somebody sold their property, when they sold their land because they were in dire straits and they had to for some reason, the first person that it would be offered to would be a kinsman. So you would have someone who would be called a kinsman redeemer. And they would purchase that property, and the point was to keep the property in the family. So as long as the family had that property, then technically you still owned it. You still had access to it. If you sold it out of the family, you didn't anymore. But sometimes it did happen that way. But here's the thing. Every 50 years and the year of Jubilee, property would go back to the original people who owned it. Can you imagine? If you bought a house from someone and 50 years later, you had to move out and give it back. Just like, okay, here it is back. Okay, but they had laws and they had protections set up for that, depending on how close to the year of Jubilee you bought the field. Like, okay, it's only 10 years. You only have use of this of 10 years. So you only have to pay a certain amount for that field. Okay, so it's different than how we would work it in our day and age. And the reason they did that is because they believed that the property belonged to God. And he was just lending it to them to live on while they were alive. So they could sell it and they can move it around, but every 50 years it would go back to God, which was represented by the family that God gave that property to. Okay, so this is the field that we're talking about. Okay, now so what's this treasure in a field business? And do you just like there's just treasure in the field? You know? Well, here's the thing, is it's very possible that there was just treasure in the field. So the rich people, the rich merchants who didn't necessarily have land, they typically would divide their wealth into three parts. One part they would use for running their business. One part they would make into small, expensive items like jewels, and they would stash that somewhere. And then one part they would keep liquid so that if they were driven off the land, if they were driven out of the country, they could take that with them. So since there was a lot of turnover during the Roman occupation, a lot of people, a lot of merchants would have hid their jewels, buried them possibly in a neighbor's field, and then were driven off with one third of their wealth. If they came back, they knew where the rest of their wealth was. If they didn't come back, it was just there. It was just in some field somewhere. And there is also a story. I hope I'm not boring you guys with this. There's also a story that was legendary at the time when Jesus was on the earth. And this is, it's a true story. The legend is the treasure part of it. But a guy named Mardonius. He was a Persian general, and he was defeated at the Battle of Plateau by a guy named Polycrates. This is 500 years before Jesus was on the face of the earth. Okay, now, there was a rumor that Mardonius buried his treasure in the field where his tents were pitched during the battle. And so Polycrates was looking for his treasure. And he looked and looked and looked and couldn't find it. So he went to the oracle at Delphi. And the oracle at Delphi said to him, "Leave no stone unturned." That's where, have you heard that ever before? That's where it comes from. So when you say that, you're quoting the Oracle of Delphi. Okay, so Polycrates went back to the field and started turning stones over. He found the treasure. And this is the legend part of it. Everybody knows he found the treasure. So when Jesus is talking to the people about treasure in a field, they're thinking, oh yeah, this guy Polycrates found a treasure in a field. And it was his because he won the battle, right? Okay, so this is the picture that's in the mind when Jesus says, it's a picture of a man who found a treasure in a field. It does happen. It can work. Okay, now we have typically looked at this story as the man just like stumbles over it by accident. He's maybe one of the peasants who is plowing the field for the landowner and digs up this treasure. And he's like, oh, I've got to hide this treasure. And he puts it back. And then he goes away and tries to make enough money to buy this field, which, of course, as I explained, doesn't work at all. So what I expect has happened here is possibly this is a Jew who was driven away, but who has now come back. He knows the treasure is there. He goes to the field, he finds the treasure in his joy. He's joyful because he expected the treasure to be there, and there it is. Okay, so now, since it's his field and he's buying it back, he becomes the redeemer. This man in the story is now the redeemer of the treasure in the field. So this is because of the cultural and societal aspects of this story. This is what Jesus' listeners would be seeing. Okay, so this man acting as a redeemer. Once again, remember, Jesus is showing us in this picture, he's showing us the heart of God. And then we have the story about a pearl. The kingdom of heaven is like this. A merchant seeking beautiful pearls, who when he had found one pearl of great price, went and sold all that he had and bought it. Very similar. If you read it in your Bible translations, it will say, the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure, and then it will say, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant. And we've switched that in our mind, we've switched that, and we go, no, he must not have meant that. He must have meant the kingdom of heaven is like the pearl, right? But as I say, if we get the syntax right, we see that it's the kingdom of heaven is not like the treasure, the kingdom of heaven is not like the pearl or the merchant. It's the whole picture, the whole story. It's a very similar story, the guy looking for the pearl, with one difference. It's a different setup. We have the treasure in the field. We have directly in Hebrew culture, and this is agrarian. This is agricultural. There's a field, and it's being dealt with like the Jews would have dealt with it. But the merchant we have is, this story takes place in a marketplace. So he's a merchant. He buys and sells. So he buys the pearl, possibly to sell it again. The point of the difference is that this is Greco-Roman. And so the kingdom of heaven, again, is being expanded to include not just the Jews, but to include the Greeks, to include the Romans, eventually to include what they called the nations, the Gentiles. So these four stories give us a picture of what God is doing in the kingdom of heaven. Okay, so if the kingdom of heaven is not the treasure, if the kingdom of heaven is not the pearl, if the main actor in this story, the man who buys the field, the man who buys the pearl, if that is the divine working, and you've heard, I think both Bob and I have said this, God is the hero of the story. When we look at the parables, we're looking for God in the story. So where do we fit in this story if we're not the guy looking for the treasure? If we're not the guy buying the pearl, who are we? We're the treasure. We're the treasure that is being redeemed. We're the pearl of great price. So that's where we should put ourselves in this story. The picture of the kingdom of heaven, it's unexpected. It's going to permeate the world systems. And God, it's God who is giving all that he has to redeem his people. He's bringing them into the kingdom of heaven as the treasure. So that's us. Take that away. You are the treasure. Let's pray. Dear Father, thank you for the work that you did when you came to earth. And thank you for giving us pictures of it so that we can understand your heart. And please let us be able to get this figured out so that we do understand more and more your love for us and what you've done for us. In your name, amen.